Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to a new year of Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who smothers themselves in bat's milk for strictly medicinal purposes. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm Todd.
I'm a generous serving of front boob in a blouse for this episode, because that's the best I can do so far. Happy Christmas past, everyone.
And for a Doctor Who story of this time, there's actually a significant lack of boob. It is the Caves of Androzani.
Marry a boob, really, is there? It's almost flawless. Almost. Except for one or two glaring circumstances.
Can we just cast our mind back a few weeks to Resurrection of the Daleks? And I said that I thought that was...
still in recovery.
I said that I thought that was the worst Doctor Who story to date. Yes. And the reason it was bad was that the Doctor was barely involved. He certainly didn't really do anything to resolve anything. And it was a lot of people with guns shooting other people with guns, a lot of macho dialogue, a lot of obsession with sort of hardware and weaponry. And the funny thing is, this story has all of those flaws. It's very, very much like Resurrection of the Daleks.
There's not a lot of frock, is there?
Except however, it's really, really astonishingly good. I know that not everyone on the panel agrees with me. What's happened here is, for the first time, I think, in John Nathan Turner's tenure, perhaps since David Fisher, we've got a writer from, well, you know, the golden age of the program back, and that's Bob Holmes. And you remember that when we did our Pertwee retrospective, all of the stories I chose as good Pertwees were Bob Holmes stories. And this is really, really on another level as far as writing's concerned. And then there's Graham Harper as well, who, again, I think this is the best directed story
to date. It's his first Doctor Who. He'd only been working for 2 years. He saw this as his big breakout in the business and the industry. He really wanted to get into film, and he'd studied film very closely. And you can see this. He's a very filmic director. I would say that he understands how the movement and the action and the characters are the same thing. So the camera and the movement and the dialogue should all work together. An actor doesn't move unless it's actually part of his motivation. But you can kind of look at the stories either side of this to see where that doesn't actually happen. But here, there is no gesture that's made without a damn fine reason, even to the point of doing that very 17th century, that very Jacobean way of, shall we say, side eye to the camera. But and Perry does lovely side boob to the camera as well. there's a lot of siding to the camera. Look, some people might say it's the best episode of Blake Seven ever made.
Because that's what you think, Brendan.
Yeah,
Brendan.
I'll come back to what I think of this story later. But what I will presage it by saying, I think this is Caves of Androzani is a brilliant piece of television.
Yeah,
I'm not convinced it's very good Doctor Who.
Ooh, what do you think, Todd?
Look, I like it. I think the direction is great, and I think the direction actually helps the script. I mean, in the last couple of episodes, like all the gun stuff, I'm pretty much over.
Yeah,
and I actually like a lot of the stuff in the first two episodes more perhaps than towards the end. I mean, if I cast my mind back to when I was a kid, I didn't think it was any better or any worse than any other Doctor Who. It just was just another story. It was the first time that I knew the Doctor was regenerating.
Yeah.
Because of the 20th anniversary BBC Times radio special. So we knew all the stories that were coming this season, the first time ever. And listeners will know how much I detested the Peter Davison Doctor as a kid, and so I just wanted him gone.
Yeah.
So my focus was, look, just hurry up and die, right?
Yeah.
Get on with it. No, honestly. It was just hurry
moments.
Up, die, let's just get on with the new Doctor. That's what I want to see. And so, and I was talking to a friend of the podcast.
2016's not over, but.
Simon Moore about this. We were in year seven at the time, and we actually enjoyed the following story more, right? Because there was a new Doctor and that sort of thing. That was my perspective. I think it's well directed, but there's no doubt about it. And I understand why people are going to say it's like one of the best stories of all time, but it's not my favourite by any means.
Yeah.
Robert Holmes' dialogue is delicious.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, Todd, and it's something you raised there. Last time you were on the podcast for season 20, you had a rather disturbing obsession with the fact that almost no one was dying in the show. And we commented a few weeks ago, I think during Resurrection, that you must love Resurrection because all the deaths. I mean, the opening scene, I think 12 people are gunned down. What What's your opinion of the use of death in season 21?
I'm laughing, listeners. I'm laughing because I commented in the Five Doctors about the cyber massacre and how, like, over the top that was.
Yeah.
So I got to Warriors of the Deep and everybody gets massacred and, you know, et cetera. And I'm going, okay, that's, you know, fine.
Yep.
But got to Resurrection of the Daleks and I'm going, oh, for goodness sake, I just want this death to stop, you know.
Right.
Yes. Stop.
So I was over it. But, I mean, that story is just so bleak.
Like, you can have too much of a good thing.
There is no need to kill so many people, right? And again, this happens here. I'm all for death and dying, but I think it has to be in moderation.
Have a drink, listen.
But in Doctor Who, you need people to be killed off, but you don't need to kill everybody, otherwise it loses its impact.
And Rogue One, have we covered that?
Spoilers.
So yes, so you know, by halfway through Resurrection of the Daleks, I'm going, I don't want anybody else to die.
I think the problem with the Resurrection of the Daleks, though, isn't that everyone dies. I think that it's just incredibly terrible. And this one, where literally everyone dies except Perry and Krautimmon.
Yes.
The women live, the two women in the story live, but literally everyone else, including the Doctor, dies, including the magma creature, including all of the Queen Bats who've descended down to the lower levels to die. And you remember that Pete and Perry are dying the entire way through.
Mm.
So it was always sort of fun. I do remember at the time watching this for the first time where you're kind of wondering what's going to take the Doctor out. And,
it's deliberately set that up that way, isn't it? You really do think everyone – I thought the dodgy lift might get in the line.
but the fact that, like, really early on they fall into the Spectrox.
Well, they bounce into
they
it.
Bounce. That's hilarious. You see Nicola going, boing.
It's her bum comes back into shot.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure she goes A over T, actually, because her bum comes
she
up
is
she's
most,
turning.
She's the most buoyant of the Doctor's companions so far.
That's something that is wonderful about the story, because with the First Doctor's regeneration, it's kind of, it's seeded early on in the story that something is happening to him. And even then, that was a production necessity, because Hartnell had a week off, you know, so they had to have the Doctor collapse.
And then this as well. God, yeah, I didn't even spot him under the latex cape.
But, you know, all of the other regenerations have been something that have happened in a flash in the last episode.
Yeah.
You know, whereas this, we get this wonderful moment at the end of part three where the Doctor is trying to land Stotz's ship and starts to see the regeneration effect in front of him in the screen, and he sort of shakes it off. And a lot of people have come to the DVD since and said, you know, I never noticed that on broadcast and I never noticed it on video. It's noticing it on DVD. He's kind of shaking his head and you see from his perspective.
Really? I just thought it was cheaply reusing the same effect.
Same
you know?
Here.
Well,
I like that interpretation, though.
It's well, lovely,
according to Graham Harper, the idea is from that moment, he could regenerate at any time.
He does, like, do a lot of crawling and stumbling and stuff and falling over.
He's holding on.
He's the best falling over Doctor we've ever had.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
pratfall.
His falling is one of the best. His falling is the best thing in Terminus, let's face it.
There's not much other. Anything else to recommend
that's
that one?
True.
Sorry.
But something I've often said about this story, this seems to be the Doctor Who story that Robert Holmes has always wanted to write, because he's written it twice before. He's written it as the Space Pirates.
Yep.
And he's written it as the Power of Krol.
I was going to say, it is actually the sister story and possibly in the same universe as Power of Krol. They work together really well.
Absolutely. But I think what makes this one work so well, in Space Pirates you had the goodies and the baddies. And the baddie, Craven, played by Dudley Foster, I think, was really good.
Yeah.
The good guys, General Hermack, played by Jack May.
He was pretty funny.
I love Jack May, but he just wasn't a commanding presence, you know. In Power of Krol, really no one's a good guy.
No.
Yeah, you've got the refinery workers who are horribly racist, and you've got the Swampies who are painted as the aggressors and literally painted in green, but they're not particularly presented as having much agency, you know. They're kind of ruled by their religion, and the ones who question it don't really get much of a look in, etc. But in this story you have wonderful villains and you have wonderful quote-unquote good guys. General Chellak, he's he is a good guy by default, but at the same time, he's a complex character who makes decisions we find appalling.
Yeah. But
we
still understand sends people to die.
Yeah.
But we understand his reason, and it doesn't reduce our sympathy for the character.
You know why he was cast? You do know? No, I don't. Because Harper wanted him to be like Errol Flynn, so he found the closest actor he could get with a face like Flynn and stuck a moustache on
him. He looks like Flynn. I actually think he's a very brigadier-like. I don't know why.
That's very true as well.
I think that the way that it's written, Holmes is obsessed with colonialism. This is another colonialism thing. And so he's a sort of blustering idiot general, and he doesn't overplay that, but certainly Morgus says that he's obtuse and he just seems to be a little bit thick.
He hasn't really picked up on it all, has
no,
he?
And you know, clearly he's been
he's living with a blow up toy for the last 3 months. Yeah, hasn't quite worked it out. Yeah,
how's the hair always so perfect? Where's he getting his product from?
So he doesn't play it very big or broad. He plays it sort of fairly naturalistically, but he is disappointingly unlikable, and there's no one in the story who isn't evil. Is there? There are no good guys.
Perry's quite, as we're about to find out, you know, the quintessence. Go on.
Well, the thing is, I look at Shara as Jack and I don't think he's particularly evil.
Not at all. He's the most sympathetic.
He's a villain, certainly. And
he frocks up like one, certainly.
And it's really the beginning of the unfortunate trope of villain fancies Perry. But at the same time,
I wonder where that's going to go.
At the same time, there's a complexity to that relationship. One of the best scenes to exemplify that is when Jack gets his mask ripped off and Perry is hiding, and he goes to check on Perry.
Yes.
She sees his face and she screams and he recoils in terror.
Yeah. Yes.
But just before the camera cuts away, Perry starts crawling towards him to check on him. And it's a blink and you'll miss it.
It shouldn't have been cut quite there, should it?
Well, I think in a way it shouldn't, but in a way it leaves a bit of ambiguity as well. It's certainly an uncomfortable characterization, but there are shades of grey in most of these characters.
Mm.
I would argue with the exception of Stotts and Morgus.
Yeah. You know, I actually think that Shara's Jack is horrible and much, much more horrible than I thought he was on previous viewings. And I think the reason is that he is horrifically rapey when it comes to Perry, like absolutely revolting. And we talked last time about how Perry is here to be the victim, that she's here to be manhandled and pushed around by men.
Mm.
And it's going to be the big characteristic of her run. And the only thing that saves it is that she is so charming and she plays
and strong and Saki in this. It's very easy to forget with the big mistake that's coming up, whatever, if you want to see it that way, that and the second Bob Holmes story she does actually, where she kind of regains some of her tenure. But in this one, she's strong and feisty and totally likable and kind of the Tegan we should have had all the time.
I actually completely disagree.
Really? I find her very compassionate.
No, she is. She's lovely. Look, I really like her a lot. I think that interplay that we have with her and Pete at the beginning of episode one is marvelous, and she's really terrific in it, and Pete's really doctorish. And, you know, Richard, you said how lovely it would have been to have a season of those two together. But in fact, all we get is that one episode because the two of them are very quickly separated. And then she's very quickly incapacitated. And so when she first meets Shara's Jack, she is frightened by him. He keeps wanting to touch her and attempting to touch her, and she doesn't want that to happen, and she's flinching and screaming whenever she thinks it's likely to happen. And there's one really awful moment where Pete puts his hand on her to reassure her, but because she's in his presence, she flinches and screams slightly at Pete's
touch.
Because
she's such a good little actor.
She is a good actor, but the fact is that this is more stuff about her being a victim and her being pushed around by men. And it's really, really horrible here. One of the moments where I think maybe it can be read as sympathy because of the way that Jack looks after her when she's sick. He turns the air conditioning on, which will eventually lead Morgus and Stotts to his base. He's keeping her face cool. He's looking after her. But the way I was reading that is she's now so incapacitated that she can't even object to being touched by him anymore. Mm. She's got no power at all to do that. And I think that's awful. And, you know, Holmes is famous for his mistreatment of women. The companion who's had the worst time of any companion up until Perry is Sarah Jane Smith. Yeah. And that was on Bob Holmes's watch. Yeah. And so here she gets really, really horribly pushed around. And so I just can't read Shara's Jack as anything other than a big creepy vasor.
He was Twiggy's partner in The Boyfriend, the 1968
film. Christopher Gable, yes, the actor, yes.
He's got very nice hairy hands, doesn't he?
He astonishingly so, Brendan. Did you not notice that Graham Harper's story that Christopher Gable always called Harper Twinkle on all the previous productions, and he was absolutely terrified and mortified that he'd be doing the same thing on this, but he didn't.
Yes, sort of according to Harper, Christopher Gable was a dancer.
Actor as well.
But he saw...
And very pretty, which is why he actually had him cast as, was it Morgus or Stott? So it was one of the... Well, he was cast as one of the other roles because Harper didn't think he'd want to wear a cowl mask. But then he saw how pretty the mask was. He said, "Ooh, no, I must have that." Well, his eyelashes are lovely. He brought his own eyelashes.
Christopher Gable saw this as an opportunity to stretch himself as an actor. And there's a feature on the DVD, archival recording, because Christopher Gable is no longer with us, an archival recording where he discusses, if you like, his sort of method for getting inside the mind of the character. Graham Harper has even speculated that perhaps the reason he didn't do the whole twinkle and jokey thing was because he saw this as an opportunity to play a real part, if you like. Because I suppose as a dancer, it's very easy to end up in the chorus with no character at all. Mm. Whereas, you know, you're given a character, you're going to run with it. A little world on Graham Harper, he was uncredited as the director for several scenes of Warrior's Gate when Paul Joyce was removed from the set before being invited back on. Paul Joyce, much like Graham Harper, was trying to be a filmic director and as such fell massively behind time in the BBC set, to the point that John Nathan Turner came down and said to him, "Right, you're out. Graham and I are going to do this. Right. We don't have time." Paul Joyce went and sat in the BBC bar, and half an hour later, John Nathan Turner came to him and said, "Look, we can't decipher your shooting script. I'm sure something can be arranged." So I think Harper even then directed a few sequences afterwards, sort of simpler sequences, while Paul Joyce focused on the more complex ones. So Graham Harper makes far more a success of the filmic approach, but there are still moments that were dropped. Do we know about these?
No.
Quite a bit. Every episode overran, and they still overran, but yeah, there was quite a considerable amount cut out.
There are deleted scenes on the DVD, and there's one very famous sequence that just wasn't shot at all because they wanted to, a bit like Pertwee's departure, they wanted to tick a few boxes for Pete. So, of course, they explain what the celery is for. It turns purple in the presence of gases in the Praxis range, at which point he eats it because it's good for his teeth.
And it's a powerful restorative on the planet Gallifrey.
And can be inserted nasally.
Yes.
And they also wanted to give him a sort of heroic fight scene. And that's what the magma creature was about.
Really? I'm going to fight the magma creature?
Yeah. So in episode four, when he's trying to get to Perry, he was going to fight the magma creature. And they ran out of time. They left it the end of the day. Oh. And so it's replaced with the Doctor finding it shot, despite the fact, and Graham Harper says this, "We've seen bullets don't affect it, so what's killed it? We don't know." And that's why the Doctor finds but says, "It's not your day either." But in a way, that's more Davison than a fight scene.
Yeah, that's and it continues that theme of everything dying.
Yeah.
The magma creature has to die. The magma creature is another of sort of Bob Holmes' great...
great loves, like when he has to put in the crap creature that they have to to visualise. You know, it's a magma creature. We also get the giant bat as well.
Which is kind of
at
terrible.
At least that's covered in smoke, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when the magma creature attacks someone, and of course it's got rubbery hands. And so it stars in the cliffhanger to episode two, which is very exciting with its rubbery hands. When the magma creature attacks someone, Graham Harper just makes the camera go out of focus so that we can't see how truly terrible it is. It is shocking. It's got great abs, though.
It's well fit and great sturdy but very short little legs, because you know Janet was still actually engaged in being paid for her performance in this.
It probably played in the first 15, the Androzani major first 15.
Janet. She was still being, yeah.
We can never, ever at Janet on Twitter. You do realize this. My main problem with the magma creature is the stupid cape.
Yeah, why does it have a cape?
And the thing is, it's this rigid carapace that it doesn't quite fill out. It's
covering up something that was even worse.
It gives it a bustle. Well, I don't know. Did it look like a penis or something? That's the only reason to give something a cape in Doctor Who. Sorry, Justin Chatwood, I'm not saying you are not quite
a penis. That would be unkind.
Yes.
However.
So who else do we need to talk about? I mean, Perry's sort of sidelined because she's sick. Pete's sidelined because it's Bob Holmes doing a Saywood story.
I think we need to talk about the Trow and the Crow.
Yeah, I think we probably do.
You know who they were originally cast as, don't you?
Steed and Mrs. Peel.
I wish, and Trow Morgus. And John Normington is just the greatest thing in the history of the universe. Harper wanted Alan Lake and Diana Dawes.
Wow.
We've covered a lot of this in the fabulous story called Underworld, when we talked about Diana Dawes and Alan Lake, who were kind of like the old wheezy couple. But they were both very fine actors, Alan Lake especially. Very, very good actor. I think he would have been amazing as Morgus.
And John Normington, I think, he doesn't get the credit that he deserves for this, because I think he's absolutely superb.
Oh, he makes this.
The best thing about him is he's constantly expressing sort of regret and panic. Think about when the president falls down the lift shaft, or when the North Core copper mine blows up or whatever. And he's constantly expressing regret or these serious emotions. And he does it in this completely affectless way, which just makes him sound fabulously, superbly insincere.
How tragic.
It could have been worse. It could have been me.
Yo, it's such a chilling line.
Talking of the president down the lift well, like, I mean, I just remember that as a kid. It's just something that just sticks in your mind, like the fact that he's just done and have the attendant shot as well, the technician shot. It's just like, really? Like, you've just planned all this? It always bobs back into my mind, because in L.A. Law, a few years later, there was a character called Rosalind Shays, played by Diana
Muldaur, TV's Dr. Pulaski.
And she was sort of the semi-regular evil sort of bitch villain. They call the lift, and next thing you know, she's talking to one of the guys and just walks straight in, and the lift hasn't arrived, and she falls to her death. Yeah, you know? And I always think of Case of Androzani and think, whoever wrote that episode of L.A. Law, I reckon, must have seen this episode of Doctor Who.
It's tremendous the way that Morgus goes to shake his hand at the president, moves his hand towards him, and then he just pushes him instead. It's so terrific. And the president is wonderful as well. He's got this sort of great posh voice, and there's all this stuff about morality. The president almost risks being a good guy.
Yes, there's the level of my – I've had to suppress my ethics for power, but he actually does believe himself to be a moral man.
He certainly judges Morgus. Mm. Remember, there's that conversation about closing some of the plants in the east so that people can work no pay.
Exactly, which – well, welcome to Australia. Do you not over in the west for less than $2 a day if Ms. Reinhardt can bring them in? It's so topical.
Yeah.
But I think it gives us a really lovely posset of something Holmes was always talking about. The politicians are actually powerless. No matter how decent their motivations may be, they are nothing but puppets that can be dropped from a great height whenever necessary.
And he is cynical. I mean, the president still is cynical. He goes, you know, I suppose we might make that seem morally
weak
justifiable.
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, Holmes is a great cynic, and here he just gives it free rein.
There's not a lot of new hope in this, is there?
There really isn't.
No, it's very much a hopeless story.
As a kid, I really disliked all the asides.
Really? When he turns to camera.
Oh, look, I just hated it.
You didn't have BBC Shakespeare in school, though? You're having to sit through all of those Lal Awards doing side-eye? No.
And I just felt it got worse and worse. At first it's to the side, and then it's directly into the camera.
Yeah.
And I really disliked that.
Maybe if you'd been 3 or 4 years older, because we loved it.
And what do you do now?
But we were 15. We're sorry. This is the best thing ever.
Yeah, I just went, oh, really? Now I still am annoyed by the direct shots to camera later on. I like the earlier asides. I mean, you know, I've got that baggage from a kid and as a kid, and I, you know, but I think his performance is great. And then,
you know, it's an accident, don't you? The notes were to slightly askance to the camera, but Normington interpreted doing it as Jacobean drama, as you know, as Cod Shakespeare.
So.
You
remember House of Cards where Ian Richardson very, very frequently turns to camera, and it just shows his control of the entire television program, that there can be people around him actually listening to him, and he's so confident that he can just deliver a soliloquy.
Thank you for bringing that up, because when you see Spacey do it over the period of how long has House of Cards US been going? 17 seasons?
Something like that.
Four, at least.
Yeah, 14. Okay, yeah. But it's so successful.
Those asides, because it's weird. I had this one on video as a kid. But I don't recall ever watching it in full. I would fast forward to the end and I would watch the regeneration scene over and over again.
Mm.
Spoiler alert. I don't know if it scared me or there was something else I didn't like about it. But I never watched the full story until it came out on DVD in, 2000, 2001?
It's one of the first ones. Just check the show notes, it'll tell you.
Yeah. So, you know, first time I watched this, I was 18, 19, and those asides, I knew there were asides. I knew that. But the first time, and I think his very first aside is straight down the camera, the first time he turned to the camera, I jumped in my seat.
It's really funny. I think he just says, "You spineless cretins," or something like that. Yeah.
I mean, I just thought it was part of the direction, and what makes this story stand out
is
that direction. And also, isn't there the 3D shot where they walk around?
That magnificent 3D monitor in the middle of the room. Yeah,
yeah, which is something that, you know, hadn't been done before as well. So, you know, I think they do work. I mean, I think, you know, the direction. But one of my overriding things is in the Australian broadcast is at the end of episode 4 where the mask is pulled off Shara's Jack. It cuts from the mask being pulled off to the whole lab's
on fire
and everybody's dead. Wow. Right. That's one of the overriding things I remember. I just went, what the hell? Like the fact that his face is so hideous has caused this entire destruction, like within a second. But obviously I knew that the senses had got to it. And it's one of the few times in Doctor Who where I really went, oh my goodness, you know, there has been a big cut here.
So there are quite a few cuts. So when Shara's Jack threatens to pull the Doctor's arms and legs off, that's cut. The scene where Stotts and Krelper, where Stotts is holding Krelper down, has a knife to his neck and is forcing him to eat a cyanide pill, that's cut. The scene where Stotts, and it's a fantastic scene, where Stotts and Morgus go off, leaving Krelper behind in the shuttle, and then Stotts comes back and just casually guns Krelper down and smiles and then leaves. Mm. That was cut completely. And I've objected to that sort of thing in Doctor Who, you know, over the last little while, to, you know, pus coming out of people's faces and people screaming in terror as they're killed and all of that sort of thing. Like, I don't think that that's right for Teatime TV. But here I just think it's so confidently done and so good. And it is kind of Bob Holmes. You know, Bob Holmes has this thing where he gives Sayward what Sayward wants in a kind of stuff you sort of way.
But it's just done with more intelligence.
Yeah, it's so well done.
It's done with characters.
Rather
than archetypes.
Which we were talking about in the beginning. There is no action that is not without the character's full motivation. Yeah. It's not sanguine to the plot.
So think of that scene with Stotts and Krelper where Stotts is force-feeding him the pill.
It's very powerful now.
So it starts, Stotts is lying on the ground relaxing. Krelper stands over him. Harper shoots between Krelper's legs at Stotts, who's lying down. Mm. And then there's that conflict where it's all about men manning and being men at each other and that kind of thing.
You manned me in the face. That really hurt. Sorry, go on.
But then the end of the scene is the exact reverse of that, where Krelper has been defeated. He's lying exactly where Stotts was lying, and the camera is now shooting between Stotts' legs. And it's so thoughtful and so well done. It's grotesque and it's over the top and it's super violent and stuff, but it's really, really good at establishing the relationship between Stotts and Krelper.
I have to say, because it's been a while since I've treated the listeners to a comment from Rod.
Oh.
That scene, the end of that scene, we both just looked at each other And at the end of the story, when he was giving me his notes, he's like, that bit with the pill, bit homoerotic. I'm like, yeah. Yeah, it was. And it helps that it's Maurice Rowe's.
Yes, isn't he tremendous?
He is tremendous.
Special import, Maurice Rowe.
And a special import twice, in fact, because he did live in the States. And the original location filming, there was a scratch on the film and they had to recall him.
Wow.
And it was remounted between the two studio blocks, which presented a problem because if they couldn't get him for that location filming, they already had one studio block with him as Stotts. They couldn't recast the part. They would have had to rewrite all the stuff. He was already back in the States because I think everything he had to do in studio was done in the first studio session.
Right.
But he said, yes, of course I'll come back over. You'll have to pay for my flights and accommodation and whatnot. But I don't think he even asked for an extra fee. Or if he did, it was not a rush fee or anything like that. He was quite happy to come over and do it because he enjoyed the work so much and the quality of the script.
And because he was just sitting by the pool otherwise, wasn't he, with all those lovely pounds around him.
It was
Do you have to send overseas for an actor?
He is really good. And I think they were trying to recreate Scorby, but I mean, he's better than Scorby from Seeds of Doom. Is that right? Did I dream?
Or Captain Peacock.
Or Captain Peacock. He does play a Romulan
many
years later.
He plays Captain Peacock in the Are You Being Served reboot, Todd.
Yeah,
Scorby, yeah.
Yes, not Maurice Rose.
No, Maurice Rose. No, he's Miss Brahms.
he's a Romulan in a really terrible season six Star Trek episode. Yeah, that's right.
Which also features Linda Thorson as a Cardassian. And it's just like, I wish she'd come back on Deep Space Nine because she's fabulous.
She's really good in that.
And she just walks in and insults everyone without even opening her mouth. She's brilliant.
Speaking of brilliant, Crow Timman.
Yes.
So I think she's wonderful. And I just like the way how she swans in and is asked to do all this sort of stuff. And you're kind of not sure if she's really taking any interest in it at all. And then it's just so delicious when she just turns the table on Morgus at the end. But, you know, to promote this secretary to this position, she has obviously got files on so many people. And it's not like she's actually really a nice person because she's in it for herself to get that job. But I just think it's a fantastic moment in the story.
Yes, it really is.
She does question him one time. Is that there's a wonderful moment where Sharaz Jek says that he wants the head of Morgus at his feet congealed in its own evil blood.
Mm.
And then we crossfade to the head of Morgus, and the head of Morgus is issuing the directive about the director of the South Core copper mine. I think every time I mention that mine, it's from a different point of the compass. I can't remember which one it is. But he's died, and he orders all of the staff to stand silently for a minute in remembrance of him, and then he goes, no, wait a minute, make that half a minute. And she kind of does the eyebrow at him as if she, you know, can scarcely believe it. And that final scene where she comes in, she's at Morgus's desk, and she just completely schools Morgus and tells him off. And she does it, like, not from close up. We never actually see her directly. She's on a video screen. She's like on a television, which is, you know, in the middle of the frame. She's not very big in the frame, but she absolutely controls the scene nevertheless. And she's sitting there with her feet on Morgus's desk. She's just tremendous.
That, though, is so Shakespearean as well. Not just the portrayal of the lieutenant, if you like, but say at the end of Macbeth, when the battle is being lost, a soldier comes in and says to Macbeth, the battle is being lost, and it's just all off stage. Well, this is off stage, and it's so off stage, it's just in the video monitor. It's just from the perspective of Morgus, who is the hubristic figure in this, just like Macbeth was. And Morgus has killed the king. He's killed the president. Not exactly to assume the office of the president, but to assume the power, as Macbeth does as well. And in this, you've got Crow Timman just reporting from afar, you know, the battle is lost, sir, I am the messenger from the battlefield. But it's got that modern twist of, you know, if Shakespeare had video screens at the back of the stage, he would have used that kind of thing, you know, because that is the modern messenger at this point. It's really clever of Holmes and Harper, and especially the way Harper shoots it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not even, the camera isn't even directly on the video screen. The video screen's at an angle, it's in the middle, it's not a very big part of the frame, but she completely owns that scene.
And especially it's the only time that Morgus looks surprised in the whole story.
Yeah.
Yeah. And even then his voice doesn't waver. He's still got that crap to me. Why are you sitting at my desk?
So he's wonderful. Brilliant.
He's so good. Well, I don't think there's a weak performance in any of this. And we've talked about Chellak and Sharazjek and Morgus and...
Janet Fielding.
Janet Fielding.
Saladin is, for me, initially, whenever I watch this, I kind of think, oh, that performance.
But those teeth.
He's bad looking, isn't he?
I think it comes down to the fact that he's playing an android. And then you see the difference in the actual... real one versus his android version,
and
it makes me appreciate what he's doing. But initially, I always go, you're a bit crap, but I understand why.
I think the android is spectacular, and there are some great moments where, so for instance, he sees the real Saladin and Perry in the next room through the wall, but he doesn't say anything, and it's all just told visually. And he has this great eyebrow thing as well. He's constantly behind Chellak because Chellak's always forward in the frame, and Saladin's behind him talking to him. And he does lots of turning and raising his eyebrow. And there's that wonderful thing where Pete suggests to Sharazjek that Saladin can't be a perfect copy and that someone will eventually see through it. And again, we cut or maybe even crossfade to an interaction between Chellak and Saladin, where Saladin is just super ludicrously efficient, you know, in this really preposterous way. And then we cut back and there's no dialogue explaining why we're going to that or anything like that. It is just this, and here's why Saladin's not going to be convincing.
Yeah, you can see how Fassbinder's completely based his entire performance for Alien, Prometheus and Covenant. It's coming up.
I think also Saladin is another example of characters who you might expect to be good guys being evil, and it happens twice that when a character is told that both Perry and the Doctor are suffering from spectroxoxemia, the character laughs at them. And Saladin laughs uproariously at the revelation and is kind of glad about it. And so he's evil as well. Everyone we meet is evil.
The thing is, though, with that laugh, I've got a slightly different interpretation of it. He's been prisoner with Sharazjek for months, so all he's got for company are androids and a madman.
Yeah,
he's started to go a little bit mad himself, and that laugh he does, it's not a kind of I find this hilarious laugh. It's an hysterical,
ironic
reaction, and it's not because they're dying. It's because Sharazjek has been foiled again.
Yeah. Yes. Although he does say to the Doctor, I don't suppose you see the funny side of it.
Yeah. And I love the Doctor's reaction to it. Oh, marvellous sense of humour. What do you mean we're dying? Pete is so darkly funny in this. Like when Sharazjek is saying, oh, you know, I've got company now. The Doctor says, oh, yes, long walks on the beach, picnics, well-prepared meals, that sort of thing.
It's Holmes again, we talked about this when Bidmead was writing for the Doctor in Frontios, and he just said, stuff it, I'm writing Tom Baker dialogue, and Pete delivering that just absolutely shone. And here you've got smart mouth Pete doing what he should always have done. I mean, it's still the same acting performance, but he's got such good dialogue to play.
And it is his best performance.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And, you know, he even tries to kind of laugh Perry out of it when they're prisoners and they're about to be sent before a firing squad and he's making jokes with her. And
do try and speak English, Perry.
Yeah. But it's kind of gentle. And when she does say that she's scared, he doesn't then dismiss it. He's like, oh, okay, I'll stop doing the jokes now. And Nicola's brilliant in that scene. She's like, I don't mind dying. I don't want to be shot. It's just a very subtle thing. Thing is, when he's then pacing up and down trying to figure it out, she is also looking around the situation and kind of warns him that, well, you don't have very long. I think they're about ready for us. You know, she is incredibly brave.
She gets that funny line too about when they're discussing the itching and the blisters and stuff like that. And she says, I don't suppose we'll die of it in the next hour, which I think is really pretty terrific.
Yeah. We did lose another scene on the last studio day in the TARDIS because this story, and then The Twin Dilemma was affected by industrial action as well. The scene shifters strike.
Of course.
So the last studio session of this was actually the first studio session of The Twin Dilemma, right, which we'll be discussing in a couple of weeks. Then the last studio day overran, and they very wisely said, we've got to get the regeneration and we'll do that first, and if we get time, we'll do the opening scene. And the opening scene was meant to be explaining why they'd come to Androzani Minor.
I think you can work it out, right? I haven't seen the scene, but they came there to get some sand, to get some glass, to make a new reticular vector gauge.
That's right. That's right. And what the conversation essentially is the Doctor explains all that, and Perry said, oh, do you have glass-making material? Oh, I learned glass-blowing from the monks of Barastabon 6. And she says to him, what were you doing in a monastery? And he says, I haven't known you long enough to tell you that. Oh, you're such a pain, Doctor. So when they dropped that scene, they decided it was too long to just have it in overlay as we get we get in the finished product. So they went back and just redubbed enough information to get through to the new scene. But it does then give Perry that weird line of they wanted to get some sand.
To blow
some glass to create a new reticular vector gauge.
Yes, her accent does drop there. I did note that in my notes.
I actually wondered whether there had been something in that scene about Pete making fun of her for saying glass. And so she says glass.
You'd think so.
It's a possibility, certainly. That's a pretty masterful thing. There's a beautiful glass shot at the beginning. By the artist Jean-Pierre, who did glass shots earlier in the season and for Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. The only thing is, because it's film, it kind of wobbles, but on the DVD they fixed that, so it doesn't wobble and the glass shot is nice and stable. But you can select that as an additional option, dear listener, who want to wobble, who want the original spanner in the Pirate Planet, God damn it!
So we have two cliffhangers that we need to talk about before we leave this story. And one of them is the cliffhanger to episode one. Do any of you, not you, Brendan, do any of you remember this as a child?
Yes, and I thought they get shot and, well, the guns go off. And I actually sat there going, how are they going to get out of this?
We had conversations about it at school the next day.
Did you? Yeah. Well, we'd just seen the Diana Rigg episode, The Living Dead, on first broadcast after about 15 years on Australian TV the same year, and which was a similar thing. But you hear the guns going off and there's Emma Peel. I think the only time we ever see her with a machine gun, killing 12 people.
Cool.
And and she's really good at it. We thought, actually, could have a bit more of this. and saves Patrick McNee. So it's almost shot for shot. So, if you'll pardon the pun. So in this one, it was the topic of conversation over the seos.
It's done like a magic trick as well, because they pull the cloak down over their faces and the music is all this drum
like
roll.
Two plum puddings waiting to be immersed. Yes.
And it isn't quite a cheat, I think, because you do get that montage of Shara's Jack. He's got the two of them on the screen. He sends for two androids. There's things going through pipes. He's pressing some buttons. Mm. They're curiously affectless when they are about to be executed, so they could be androids. So he doesn't just pull it out of a hat.
Yeah.
And the way it's resolved is so incredibly well done, because we get the execution, we see that they're dead, they get cut down, we go back to the conversation between Morgus and the president that was interrupted at the end of episode one, and then we see Pete and Perry walking into Shara's Jack's headquarters, and only then do we find out that they were androids.
Mm. I do think that it's hilarious that Shara's Jack can just produce these androids very, very quickly. He's got a great production line.
Yeah. I think the master and probably Rex Farrell helped him install it.
Well,
you want to know something, though. Salatine did see them a while ago. So Android Salatine could have been relaying information back, like Data in Star Trek can very quickly measure things.
But he has cameras everywhere, and he did have a shot of them.
There's two things I love about that cliffhanger so much, and one of them is the president's line just before the cliffhanger, who he's disgusted by the fact they're getting the Red Shroud for executions, because the Red Shroud was for soldiers. And Morgus kind of looks at him like, what does it matter?
Yeah, you are crazy.
The other thing I love about this cliffhanger is, apparently, as scripted, the music was meant to come in before the guns fired. It was meant to be ready, aim, but it was Graham Harper who said, no, let's actually have the guns firing, make it even more. As you say, Todd, how are they going to get out of this one? Mm. And I think that is such a great subversion because we expect it to be ready aim. We expect it to be the doctor kneeling down with the Miller overhead with the scythe. And then someone comes in and says, stop!
Wait!
But no, nobody...
a lot under Sayward, yes.
Yeah, and that's... So maybe that's, you know, Robert Holmes subverting again, although, and I'm not saying this to be uncharitable, I doubt Robert Holmes was watching every week, if at all.
No.
You know, he probably...
No, he said he had hardly seen, he hadn't seen Peter Davis and he wrote for Tom.
Yeah.
So it works so well, though, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, which means you can just, as we've said before, you can write great lines and any actor can do it. Yeah. You don't write for a doctor, you write for the doctor.
Yeah.
But I will say that when I saw this at 18, obviously I knew they weren't dead at the end of episode one because I'd seen the regeneration, but I didn't know the beats of the story. I didn't know how they got out of it. And then the great storytelling trick is as soon as they walk into Shara's Jek, you go, of course he can make androids.
Yeah. It is that which thing where knew, it's not do they survive that we care about, it's how do they survive. And so having them survive before you say how they survive I think was terribly clever.
Yes, yes.
The other cliffhanger?
Well, the cliffhanger, is it a cliffhanger? Let's call it the end of episode four.
Okay, the regeneration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So Pete's almost upstaged by Nicholas Cleavage. He likes to go on about that story. Yes. Yes.
It's the first regeneration where there hasn't really been an arc or any other umbrella meaning, overwinning meaning to it. There isn't a journey. There isn't, you know, the self-discovery. There isn't. There's in every other's Doctor Who renewal, if you want to call it for that, and Colin is about to presage that as well, isn't he? But there's always been some meaning behind it. Here, it's just another incident to the plot. It's meaningless, and that's what Holmes is always. That's Holmes's really cynical humour is. Yeah, this has just happened because somebody made a wrong turn.
I think that that's true. Like he dies sort of by accident, but he's also found himself in a situation where his stuff doesn't work anymore. And the thing that reminded me,
being charming doesn't save you in this world.
I'm the doctor and this is my friend Perry, and it has no effect. He gets shut down immediately. And the thing that reminded me most of is episode one of the War Games, where the doctor turns up for all we know in World War One, which is a real horrific historical event, and he has no power to prevent himself from being executed at the end of that first episode. Mm. And it seems inevitable. He can't do anything. None of his charm, none of his usual stuff works. And here, all of Pete's usual stuff just completely fails to work. And this is a story where he hasn't saved anyone, where he hasn't changed anything, where he's been powerless to have any effect on this situation. So it's finally the Doctor faces a situation that just kills him.
Mm. What I like about that sort of tension, though, is, and it's happened a lot to Peter Davison's Doctor, that he's a bit of a whipping boy of the universe. You know, something goes wrong, he immediately gets locked up and the plot keeps on happening without him. Whereas here...
This may be part of your objection, Todd.
No, I'm not objecting.
I agree completely. It was a lot of wastage of the principal character. Yeah.
But here, you know, he spends the first three episodes trying to be charming. He tries to charm Chelak, he tries to charm Shara's Jek, he tries to charm Stotts, and he tries to charm Morgus.
And but, that android. And he tries to charm that android.
Yeah. Thing is, that works, you know. and I love that X-ray thing where his hearts are outside his lapels. But... what seems to happen is after he's tried to charm Morgus and that hasn't worked, I think he's kind of figured out, you know, he's going up the food chain a bit. So, you know, a general, then the general's enemy, then the general's enemy's enemy, and then the general's enemy's enemy's boss. And at that point, he just goes, okay, you know what? It's not working. You want me to be mean? You want me to be nasty? I'm going to steal this ship. I'm going to crash it. I'm going to get back to my friend, and to hell with a lot of you.
Mm.
And he becomes this really powerful character, but he doesn't forget his manners. Because when Stotts burns through the door to get to him, he says, ah, Stotts, have you enjoyed your rest? You might want to hold on to something because I don't know how to land this thing. And that's the thing. He, in becoming this more action-driven character who has kind of gone, I've given you all a chance. Forget all of you. He doesn't become like David Tennant ranting and screaming. He keeps his calm, he keeps his cool, but he's just like, no, I'm done with this. I'm going to do the only thing I can do now. I've tried peace between you. I've tried persuading you against violence. None of you are listening. I'm just going to save my friend now.
Yeah.
And I think that is so powerful, and that is so central to Pete's character, especially seeing as, you know, we've discussed the fact that his doctor is so emotionally reserved.
Mm.
He's not giving up on his principles, but he's kind of like, these people are not interested in my principles, so I will use the one.
You don't
I'm going to use the one principle I have left, which is I'm not going to let another one of my friends die.
It's an amazing final episode, actually, because I think he only exchanges a handful of lines with Shara's Jack, and that's it. The rest of the time he's running and
stay
being
warm,
shot at.
Says to him. And
stay warm.
And then we get all the floating heads.
Yes, yes. So Janet and Mark are still under contract.
It is a bit Futurama, isn't it? Mm. Yeah.
I believe they recorded Gerald Flood's line as comedian, Turlo speaks the truth, Doctor. I believe they recorded that at the end of Planet of Fire, so that was pre-recorded.
Okay.
But they had to issue new contracts for Anthony Ainley, Matthew Waterhouse, and Sarah Sutton. And there was some concern, I believe, that I think Matthew Waterhouse was overseas during the initial filming
dates. Is he doing Hamlet in London? That is a notorious production of Hamlet.
Yeah, you know, and well, that one? He did it in Connecticut
Matthew
as
Waterhouse.
Well.
Yeah.
Was it dinner theatre or...?
I don't know.
Should we put some of the reviews up? We should.
But when they moved the filming dates, he was suddenly available again. But there was discussion of not having him in there.
Because he was dead.
The rationale was they could get away with it because the character was dead. But I think it's so much more effective having him come up last.
It's Pete's last word too, isn't it?
Yeah. And as rationalized by Eric Saywood in The Twin Dilemma, thing that pushed the doctor on because he never really liked Adric and he felt guilty. Thank you, Eric Saywood.
We'll talk more about that novelization in a couple of weeks. Yeah. It really is a cynical piece of work.
Well, you know that Saywood was espousing at conventions that he wrote a great deal of this script.
Yeah, really? Well, yes. Look, I mean, he wrote
the whole salary piece.
he will go on to write this script again at the end of the next season. Only not quite so well.
Also directed by Graham Harper.
Yeah.
And so the regeneration happens.
I think the regeneration's pretty amazing. Right. There's that thing where the light pours out.
Life,
He's definitely lying down as Pete. He suddenly sits up in his column. And instead of the roll back and mix thing that we used to get, it is just suddenly bang. He sits up in his column.
Yeah. And
with his flies open. Do you know that story?
No.
That was Pete's spare costume, but Colin couldn't get the flies up. So, because he's a big boy, even back then, and he famously mooned Sandra Dickinson on set, Peter's then wife, and got a rousing murmured cheer from the rest of the production staff, who had apparently been completely ostracized by Sandra over the last three seasons, which was not the easiest of guests.
No. You can go to Pete's autobiography for more of that.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that costume, which, as Colin quite freely says,
was side splitting. Yes.
Well, also split up the back. There was a V cut out of the back of the pants. Peter then had to wear that costume to do Time Crash.
So, no.
Well, you know.
Beautiful. It was still around.
It was still around.
Ian Levine hadn't been doing it as a party piece.
Was that the Doctor Who experience? Graham Harper has said about the regeneration effect that he got it to about 90% of where he wanted it to be. And he says that on the commentary, and Peter and Nicola are just saying, what? But it looks great. He's like, no. You know, you never have enough time to do exactly what you want. But I got it about 90% there, which says a lot about the man.
Mm.
But yeah, of course, A Day in the Life. Mm. The note at the end of the Beatles' Day in the Life was the influence for that sort of chord that plays as we're going into the Howl Round kind of effect. First time we've seen Howl Round since 1973. And then, yeah, you get that explosion and Colin sits up and, yeah.
And he gets to say some lines by Bob Holmes, which is kind of nice.
He'll do that again.
Is it Bob or is it?
We wish it was next. In about four stories' time.
Yeah.
I really like that bit.
That's three eyes in one breath.
Well, I do. I was quoting. I really like that bit where, for the first time after a regeneration, a doctor is actually really self-assured. It's not like he just kind of sits up and looks around dazed like Davison did. It's not like he's unconscious like John or Tom were, and it's not like he can't focus on his surroundings like Pat was. He just sits up and straight away he's like, yes, it's me, hello. It's just very quiet and very self-assured, and I wish they'd continued that quietness and self-assuredness.
I'm glad he lost the eyeliner, though. There was a hell of a lot of eyeliner in that shot.
Oh, there's still a hell of a lot of eyeliner in 2 weeks.
Oh, is there?
Yes. Okay.
It's very much the Shatner approach to main character acting, isn't it?
I like the confidence. More of that. I like the confidence in that moment, in that performance, but I'll talk more about that.
He does fluff his line, though, doesn't he? That final line.
Does he?
Well, he's supposed to say, and it seems not a moment too soon, but he appears to say, and it seems on a moment too soon.
Oh, I always heard it as not.
It's always not.
Yeah. Have another listen.
No, it's definitely not.
Not.
I've heard him say things about his dissatisfaction with his delivery of that line.
Before we say farewell to Pete, Todd, you had Peter at a convention. I know you had Nicola at a convention.
No, I never had Peter.
But you definitely had Nicola, yep. So to speak. And did she talk to you about this first story and her expectations for the role that perhaps didn't quite come to fruition? You know how she said to you, or she said to us all, that she'd written a backstory for the character of Perry? She'd sat down like a proper little actress starting out in a career, and that she, Howard and the doctor, were, you know, she saw as very much, or her original father, she saw is very similar, yeah. But Howard was, of course, more like the master and was cast as written as a much older character. But now Perry had Nicola had written a full backstory for her character, which never got to happen because she talked to Pete about how they would both express this to the role, and Peter went,
actually, I'm off.
But the only thing that bobs into my mind is that, you know, she's talked about the fact that Pete spent the entire production winding her up over the fact that this Colin Baker person was coming in and just winding her up, as to how bad it was all going to be. and that's why it takes them the next story to really work out, not only on screen but behind the scenes, to get into a proper working relationship because of this thing that's been built up into her mind. Very naughty.
Todd, before we go, because I think this is going to be important in 2 weeks' time with the Twin Dilemma as well, what did the audience think of this story?
It's no better or no worse than the rest of the season.
It picks up a cool million for the last two episodes.
It does. 6.9, 6.6, and then the last two episodes in that week are 7.8, so it does jump because it's the end of the Doctor. Mm. Yeah, and it places, those two episodes play 62nd, you know. Right. The previous week was 66, 75, so, you know, it's one of the higher rated ones of the year.
So, okay. So Peter, over the last 3 years, has really sort of hovered around the 7-8 million mark. You know, he hasn't lost that many.
Well, I mean, I think looking at it, probably 6.5 to about 7.5 is where most of his stuff sits after that first season.
Do we think that the Monday Tuesday thing was a mistake?
Well, I mean, it's been juggled around like two nights a week for the last 3 years, you know, and so they're going to change that for next year because they felt that it needed to be on at a set time rather than, you know.
Yeah.
So decisions have been made behind the scenes, but I might talk about that more next week and next season, because there's going to be, you know, they've made a lot of decisions over the last few years that have worked out for the positive of the show just by happy accidents, things have happened.
Yeah.
But now decisions are going to be made and it's going to go the opposite way.
Dear listeners, we bid a fond farewell now to Peter Davison, but do come back next week for our retrospective looking at his entire era. Over on Bonfinger, we will be shortly releasing View to a Kill, finishing off the Roger Moore era as we finish off Peter Davison. You can find that at bondfinger.com, Bonfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and BonfingerCast on Twitter.
We cover him in sticky stuff and he gets a rash.
Don't forget to check out flightthroughentirety.sexy, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and at FTE Podcast on Twitter. And Nathan has recently regenerated the randomizer.net, where you can now find an array of options. You can get it to randomly pick you a story based on Doctor, story length, missing episodes, not missing episodes. And if we've recorded a Flat Through Entirety podcast, you can even find it through going through there. Until our Peter Davison retrospective next week, may none of your trampolines be Spectrox nests. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
Stop, does he?
I think there's something in that for all of us. That was Flight Through Entirety with Todd Bielby, Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones, Richard Stone, and his Kenneth Williams doll. Theme arrangement by Cameron Lamb. This episode, Men Manning and Being Men at Each Other, was recorded on December the 28th, 2016. The next episode will be released on January 15th. If you'd like to jump in the mud bath with the rest of us, you can at least buy us some Spectrox first.
Yeah, I think
Well, the thing is, I've had to stop waxing
you
mine
could have
because
stopped waxing,
the last time I waxed it, I've had about 50 ingrown hairs, and I just look like I've got fucking measles now.
No, don't wax it. As long as you don't engage the zipper while you're doing it, we assume that you actually have a zipper.
Are we actually recording at the moment?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, this is where we get our tag scenes.